You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
More than 40,000 Canadians served in Afghanistan over more than a dozen years. And the last of them came home in 2014. But a lot of them still think of people they left behind. Not only their fellow soldiers who lost their lives, but the people who helped them survive, who helped them navigate dangerous territory and heated conversations, who helped them understand culture and customs, and should have been rewarded for those efforts. Most of them, though, were not.
I'm urging the Honorable Sajjan, Mendocino, and Garneau, do the right thing and approve visas for these interpreters that work with the Canadian Armed Forces so that they can come here with their families and provide for them a much better life. Time is of the essence. There is not much of it.
Now that U.S. forces are also withdrawing from Afghanistan, the danger to the interpreters who served with Canadians will only get worse. Canada once had a program to fast-track visas for these interpreters. That program ended years ago, when our involvement in Afghanistan did. Now, Canadian veterans are calling on the government they fought for to protect the Afghans who helped them survive their tours of duty. Will the government listen? If they do, will it actually act fast enough to save lives in what is a rapidly deteriorating situation? What does Canada, as a country, owe to the interpreters who put themselves in harm's way to help our forces survive? And will they get it? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Lieutenant Colonel Mark Popov deployed twice to Afghanistan during a long career with Canada's armed forces, where he worked with interpreters in Afghanistan, but also in the former Yugoslavia, in South Lebanon, and the Syrian Golan Heights. He is now part of a growing number of Canadian Forces veterans calling for more to be done for those who helped them so much overseas. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning.
When we called you up to talk about Afghan interpreters, or just, I guess, when you talk with anyone about Afghan interpreters, who's the first person that comes to your mind?
Would be my interpreter that served with most of my time in Afghanistan. Well, there were two that I had, and I'm wondering what happened to these guys and where they are. So the interpreters I worked with are the first two people that come to mind.
Tell me a little bit about them, if you don't mind. Like, how'd you meet them and what did you do with them? And, you know, I think a lot of people don't quite understand the relationship and how tight it is.
Well, one thing we have to understand is that when the Canadian Armed Forces deploy somewhere, typically they do what are called rotations, where a group of troops will come over. Usually it's a 6 or 8 month tour of duty and then return to Canada. So you would have troops from Petawawa, Valcarce, Edmonton cycling through. And it's often been said that we weren't in Afghanistan for 11 years. We were there for 11 one-year tours. And if you divide that into 6 months, that's 22 different tours. Now, the people that never left were the interpreters. And in understanding a complex society like Afghanistan, particularly in the tribal areas in Kandahar province where we worked, from the Western mindset, you know, 2 or 3 days of cultural awareness is not enough to get us ready for it. So the interpreters were more than just language translators. They were our window into how tribal dynamics worked, how society worked, who the power players were, what the nonverbal cues in any conversation was. They would talk to us afterward and say, I don't think he was telling you the truth, boss, or he didn't want to talk about this. Stuff that we would not pick up just from a pure linguistic interaction. So our interpreters were quite honestly in Afghanistan, the body of corporate knowledge that we relied on as different groups of Canadians cycled in and out. So I met my interpreters when I took over the area that my combat team is about 250 troops of all different combat trades. So I had armored reconnaissance troops, I had infantry soldiers, I had engineers, combat engineers, I had artillery soldiers all in my group. So we took over from in October of 2009 in Kandahar province from a combat team from Valcarce. And the interpreters who were employed by the larger sort of Canadian contingent, they just remained. So they had worked for the previous group, and then they stayed in place and started working for my group. Because of the security situation, they lived in our camps, they lived with us ate with us, spent all their time with us as part of our team. So it was a very close relationship by necessity, and it was absolutely vital for me to understand in a brief time. I couldn't in no way get an entire handover of a 6-7 month rotation from my predecessor and ask all the right questions. So the interpreters were key in getting all my folks up to speed on the location we were now living and operating.
I can imagine in a situation like that where they're, you know, seem to be so closely tied to Canadian forces, that probably creates some pretty dangerous dynamics for them outside of the base.
Absolutely. Not only for them, but their families. I'll give you an anecdote. So our interpreters, and this was funny, those who didn't understand the relationship thought we were ignoring their culture. And it's completely the opposite. So our interpreters all chose Western-sounding names to be addressed by. And this was not because we couldn't pronounce their own names. We couldn't pronounce Abdul Rashid, and we respected their names, but it was for their security. They didn't want to be known as Abdul from Coast Province to the locals, because the word could get back to the Taliban and their families could be threatened. So Our interpreters, instead of being Abdul, Muhammad, Rashid, Khyber, they were Bob, Bill, Don, Chris, Paul, Gord. So they all chose their own name. They were proud of the names they had chosen because that kept them safe. So absolutely, they took risks, and their families were at risks no matter where they were in Afghanistan, just by virtue of these interpreters working for us.
Do you know of anything that happened to any of them or their families while you were there or previous or post your tours?
I do know that a couple of our interpreters during my latest deployment had left our service because they were worried about their families, whether family members were sick or they were worried about threats to their families. Also, I had a couple of interpreters that had worked previously for Americans and chose to stop working for the Americans and started working for another contingent, whether it was Canadians or Danes, because of the perceived threat would be higher against interpreters working for Americans in their minds. So I do know the interpreters were hesitant to talk with us about their families. It was almost like they didn't want to burden us with that sort of knowledge. But I know a lot of them, you know, you'd see them on their phones, you know, talking with their family members with a lot of worried looks on their faces. So there were threats made to the families of the interpreters during both my deployments to Afghanistan.
In a couple of minutes, we'll talk about what we need to do for these people. But first, maybe let's touch on what, if anything, has Canada done so far for any of the interpreters who've worked with the forces? Like, how does that relationship work once the army leaves or the forces withdraw?
Well, that's a really good question, and quite honestly, I don't know. I don't have all the answers. I know in the years immediately after I came back from Afghanistan, so, you know, 2011, 2012, 2013, I wrote a number of letters of reference for a number of my former interpreters, because I had about 30 or 40 attached to my team at different times. So I wrote, when each of these interpreters, when we left the mission, we would give them a letter. I would sign it as the commander, a letter of reference saying, you know, from this date to this date, he worked for us, he was reliable. And some of these interpreters had files with, you know, 10, 15, 20 letters in it from different Canadian commanders. So between giving them their own reference letters, and then I wrote some reference letters that were forwarded to, I believe, Immigration Canada on behalf of interpreters who had applied for visas. I believe there had been some sort of special fast-track program a few years ago for them. But quite honestly, I didn't follow the issue until I got just restarted in it, about a year ago, following it again.
Tell me how you got restarted into it.
The Member of Parliament for Thunder Bay, Dr. Marcus Pawlowski, one of his constituents had gotten the member engaged in the interpreter issue, and one of the interpreters that was still in Afghanistan was trying to come over had been one of mine. So he had a letter with my signature on it as reference. So Dr. Pawlowski's office reached out to me, you know, confirmed, you know, do I know this individual? Would I vouch for him? I wrote another letter, and that's how I became re-engaged right around December of 2020.
I've seen a number of veterans, yourself included, sort of loosely lobbying for this. Is there any organized plan? What are you guys doing?
Well, I know there's an organized plan and a Facebook group run by a retired captain named Dave Morrow. It's a, I guess you'd say, an informal organization of concerned veterans. I don't think the Department of National Defense is doing anything about this, and I'm not sure what immigration is doing about this at all. So it very much seems to be grassroots at this time.
The big story will be back in just a minute.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
You mentioned that during your time there, your group would have 30 or 40 interpreters. So we must be talking about a relatively large number of Afghans who were working with Canada overall during the time there.
Well, I would think so. And in addition to the interpreters, there were also at each of the camps, local Afghans, like each of the small Canadian outposts, local Afghans would be hired to do work, a lot of cleaning work or some construction work, stuff like that. And that was a method we used as a confidence building measure with the local elders by hiring some of their young men, giving them some income and showing the people that we were there to protect that we trusted them enough to have them work with us. So there were also, Afghans who worked on Canadian construction and humanitarian assistance projects as well. They're less visible and probably they're not as under as much threat as our interpreters would have been. But there are quite a few Afghans, much like in all our other deployments in the former Yugoslavia and everywhere else Canada's been, where we try to engage the local population and hire local workers wherever possible. So yeah, there are quite a few Afghans over the time. If you think we had Canadians in, first in Kandahar, then we had a mission in Kabul, then back to Kandahar with a large mission, 2,500, 3,000 troops, and then back to Kandahar for the training mission. And of course, for training, you need even more interpreters because so much of the training is one-on-one with our Canadian training staff training Afghan soldiers. So there were, I would imagine, more than 1,000 at least interpreters who had worked for Canada throughout our time there, at least.
I'm not trying to ask you to speak for anyone but yourself, really, but what I'm curious about is why do these folks tend to be forgotten as soon as we leave the battlefield?
Part of that is, I think, the fragmented nature of how we deploy. So when my squadron got ready to go over, my core squadron was 100 troops from Petawawa. We were deploying as part of a larger organization called a battle group, which is a collection of squadron and company-sized elements. A battle group's about 1,200 people. That was headquartered in Edmonton. So troops from Petawawa, we spent a lot of time in Edmonton and Alberta training from 2008 to 2009 to get ready to go. Once we got to Afghanistan, we were augmented with engineers, artillery soldiers to bring our numbers up, who were all from different places, whether Edmonton, Gagetown. We served together, we fought, we came back to Canada, and once we got back to Canada, our augmentees, our additional soldiers from Canada's reserve units all went back to their home stations. The soldiers all went back to their home stations, and in my own squadron, all the leadership from the rank of Master Corporal up to myself as the Major, we were all posted away to different duties within 2 months of our return to Canada. So because these cohesive groups only form, they deploy, they fight, they come back, and then they disperse, it's very hard to maintain a corporate awareness. And a lot of us, in the leadership ranks, we go on to different career level courses, advancement in your career, high pressure jobs, and unfortunately, the pace of life keeps you really from keeping things like the interpreters at the forefront because you've handed your mission over to another group. You trust the other groups doing its job, taking care, and you just kind of it kind of drops from your mind. But now, thinking about you know, the fact that, you know, Bagram Air Base has now been, you know, handed over by the Americans to the Afghans. Just recently, the Taliban posted a video on YouTube of them taking and occupying the former Canadian forward operating base at Massamgarh, where Canada's Leopard tanks were, where there were maybe 1,000 Canadian troops in the village of Panjwai, which so many Canadians fought in and around and died in and around, and occupying the Panjwai district center that Canadians helped set up. That really brings it home that we are not there anymore, and therefore those people that helped us could be under threat.
What should we do about that?
Well, I look at it and I say that our interpreters already demonstrated their commitment to, maybe not Canada as a country is a bit grandiose, but definitely to Canadians, to helping us. They've put themselves and their families at risk and threat to help us. And yeah, you could say, yes, they were paid for their jobs. Absolutely. But you have to feed your family, and there's other jobs they could do that would not have exposed them to rockets, mortars, gunfire, roadside bombs, being shot, having their families threatened. So we'll park that aside. So these folks have all been also security checked for their reliability. So I would see no reason why there would be immigration bureaucratic holdups to them coming into Canada on, I'm not sure, you know, some sort of special visa, special program. If we could fast track, you know, thousands of Syrian refugees to come in a few years ago and set up, you know, reception centers and programs and deploy military troops to assist with getting these folks screened and vetted and into Canada, then surely we could do something more than we're doing right now for our Afghan interpreters in terms of letting them come to Canada if they want.
What kind of response have you and some of the other veterans been getting as you've told these stories? You know, I'm one of the folks in media who admittedly sort of let the Afghanistan story drift off the map as Canada's involvement ended. And I had not thought about the people who worked with us that were left behind at all.
Well, I think a lot of us are in that same boat because, you know, quite honestly, it wasn't in the forefront of my mind. But I will tell you that as recently as yesterday, I've had my fellow veterans reach out to me and say, hey, we saw your piece on CTV News. You know, my interpreter sent me an email. He's still stuck in, you know, in Kandahar City. How can we help these people out? So from a grassroots level, from my former soldiers that I've worked together with, former supervisors, my peers, has been strongly supportive.
Has anybody in government, aside from your MP who initially reached out to you, engaged on this?
I don't think so, from my perspective. I mean, I got a message by email from my own member of parliament, and just a message of support for my efforts to help my the most recent fellow that I was helping. But other than that, no, not that I've seen.
And lastly, just asking you to speak only for yourself again, why do you think we've left these people behind? It doesn't seem to mesh with the talk we talk, I guess, about Canada's involvement overseas and what we do over there.
Well, I think we kind of, from an institutional standpoint, just viewed the interpreters maybe a bit as a resource.
Huh.
We were in Afghanistan. We, you know, used the interpreters, and I think because not a lot of our public understands exactly what we were doing in Afghanistan or exactly how our interpreters helped us, it didn't seem like a big issue. I mean, during the war, for a while, there was, you know, quite a lot of support, Red Fridays, everything like this, and then that sort of waned as people got interested in other things and forgot about it. And because the interpreters really only ever, you know, interacted with us soldiers who were there, and then we came back, and from a government and population perspective, well, we're back, we're safe, great, survived the war. But we, as military folks, and including those, you know, still serving, the you know, commanders of the missions, I guess, had never considered it as part of the plan to exit Afghanistan. And I really think we, to the detriment of people that gave a lot for us, we overlooked them institutionally.
Mark, thank you for this, and I hope your campaign starts getting some traction.
I hope so, and I'm happy to have folks like you supporting it and getting the word out so that our public understands some of what happened over there.
Lieutenant Colonel Mark Popoff. That was The Big Story. For more, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. Find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. Talk to us anytime you want via email, thebigstorypodcast, all one word, at rci.rogers.com. And of course,
Every podcast player has our show in it. You can like us, you can follow us, you can subscribe to us, you can listen to the podcast, actually, and you can tell a friend, because that's what helps this show grow. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.